Behold, in the beginning there was everything, just as there is now. The giant slap of a thunderclap, and bang, it's raining talking snakes. A greater light to rule the day, a lesser light to rule the night. Swarming water and restless air. A man goes down on two knees. A woman opens her thighs, and both hold their breath to listen. Imagining God's footsteps could be heard in the cool of the day. But God walks silently along the bank of the muddy river that flows out of the garden, the river that divides and becomes many. Usa, Kolva, Yuk, Onega, Narva, Opsha, Luga, Ohta, Volycha, Sistra, Uver, Ayat, Volga, Kama, Neva, Opi. From the windows of the house that was my childhood home, I heard a river running. The Tura hurried past our village to join the Tabol, and the Tabol joined the Irtysh, and the Irtysh joined the Opi, and the great Opi carried our cries and emptied them into the Kara Sea, which, being frozen, preserved them like flies in amber. "Go on," Alyosha said whenever I fell silent. "Please, Masha, I like to hear your voice." And I did. I told him about my father, about me, about Siberia. I told him stories my father told us when we were children. I did whatever I could to distract him. The day they pulled father's body out from under the ice, the first day of the new year, 1917, my sister Varya and I became wards of Tsar Nikolai Alexandrovich Romanov and were moved under Imperial Guard from the apartment at 64 Gorokhova Street to the Alexander Palace in Tsarskoye Selo, the royal family's private village outside the capital. 18 years old, I hardly felt I needed a new set of parents, even if they were a Tsar and Tsarina. But every week brought more strikes and increasing violence to St. Petersburg. Revolution, anarchy, martial law, we didn't know what to dread, only that we were accelerating, hurtling towards it, whatever it was. And as the Tsar's officers pointed out, having summoned Varya and me from our beds before dawn, banging at the door with the butts of their rifles, anyone with a name as inflammatory as Rasputin would be an idiot to try to leave St. Petersburg unaided and without protection. As long as the Romanovs remained in power, they represented our only possibility of escaping Russia before it was too late to get out. But first, my father. For without Grigory Yefimovich Rasputin, the end of the Romanovs is no different from that of the Habsburgs or the Ottomans or any other of the great dynasties that collapsed at the beginning of the century. Word traveled quickly, more quickly than it would had any other man's body been dragged from the river. After I signed a paper confirming that the deceased was indeed my father, missing by then for 3 days, the police escort was to return Varya and me to Gorokhova Street to gather our clothes and what few things we cared to keep. But before we could climb back into the sledge, it was surrounded by a mob. A crowd of people had come running to where we'd stood minutes before on the frozen river. They came from their homes with bowls and jugs and cast iron kettles, anything that could hold water. Some ran pouring wine and vodka, even perfume, into the gutters as they hurried to the Neva to fill their newly emptied bottles. I saw a samovar so big it required 3 men to carry it, and I saw an old woman lugging a chamber pot. Now, that would have made father laugh until he hooted and howled and dried his eyes with the heels of his hands. The idea of a withered crone ladling his ghost into her chamber pot. The crowd surged onto the river like a wave and swept all the officials away from the hole in the ice, the one out of which the police had dragged my father, beaten and bloodied, his right hand raised as if making the sign of the cross. People thronged the hole. They fell on their knees, praying and weeping. The common people, the people my father loved, all along they understood what the intelligentsia were too blind to see. They wanted the water that touched my father as he was dying, the water into which his soul had passed, through which it had swum.